In today's talk on science and the community, Sir William Bragg will describe some of the early work of the members of the Royal Society. We're very glad indeed to have Sir William with us in the studio this morning. He is the president of the Royal Society, and as director of the Royal Institution, he succeeds Sir Humphrey Davy and Michael Faraday. His work has been recognized as of international importance, and he is an honorary member of many learned societies in America and in Europe. With his son, he is perhaps best known for the way in which he has successfully used X-rays to find out how crystals are built up from atoms. Sir William Bragg.
This morning, we are going to imagine that we are present at a meeting of the Royal Society about the year 1664. The Royal Society first became a corporate body in 1662, when Charles II granted it a charter. Charles was very interested in the Society's doings. He often sent messages and sometimes even helped in the experiments. He gave the Society a magnificent gold mace, which to this day is laid before the President when business is transacted. The members of the Society in those early days met together to talk about all the curious and interesting things that were to be found in the study of nature. Very good accounts were kept of those meetings from their first beginnings. Of course, we do not know exactly what everyone said, but the accounts tell us, in detail, the subjects that were discussed and the objects that were brought for the members to see. At that time, it had begun to dawn upon thinking men that there was true knowledge to be found by appealing to nature and by making trials and experiments. There was an unconscious beginning of a great movement. Several of the great learned societies of Europe were founded about that time, and the Royal Society was among the earliest. It is clear, too, that the members, many of them eminent men of affairs, realized that whatever was found out in this way might be very important in the conduct of the state. Here were the beginnings of the idea of the relationship between science and the community. These founders of the Royal Society were rather like boys let out of school, running about to explore brooks and hedges, finding anything interesting, and showing each other what they found. Some of their discoveries were rubbish, but others were treasures, and at first they hardly knew which was which, nor how to distinguish between good and bad. Any one of you who are listening could have told them nearly always when they were right and when they were wrong. But they didn't know. They had to find out. I think it's extraordinarily interesting to notice which of their experiments led to nothing and which were the beginnings of discoveries which have had a profound effect on the history of the world. Let us imagine, then, that we are guests sitting on one of the front benches in the meeting room at the old Gresham College in London, and the members are coming in. Ah, here's Viscount Brunker, who's going to preside.
Good day, gentlemen.
Good day.
Mr. Boyle.
Ah, Viscount Brunker is talking to Mr. Boyle. Some of you will know Boyle's law of gases. And ha, here comes Mr. Hooke. Do you know Hooke's law? He's the servant of the Society and prepares experiments for them. There are several others whose names we'll hear as the meeting goes on, and there's the usual sprinkling of visitors like ourselves. Now, Mr. Boyle is going to speak.
I'm happy, my Lord Brunker, that you are to preside today. It should be a good meeting. Interesting matters to see and to hear. Will you take the chair, my lord? I think it's time we began.
Indeed, yes, sir. Gentlemen, I pray your silence. First, I have an announcement to make, which I know will give you great pleasure. His Gracious Majesty, our founder, has sent a message that he will honor us with his presence before the meeting is over. I hope we have something to show him. What have you, Mr. Hooke? You had instructions about certain experiments from our last meeting. Are they ready?
Yes, my lord. I have managed to bring my experiment of weighing the air to a greater precision.
My lord.
And I have other...
One moment, Mr. Hooker. I see there is one who is eager to ask a question. Yes?
My lord, what is this? Are we not making fools of ourselves? How can we weigh that which is everywhere about us?
But why
sir,
not?
Gentlemen,
one moment. Here is clearly a matter for a very profitable discussion. Shall we not postpone it until His Majesty comes? For surely he will be interested in it. I desire myself to be enlightened, and I would ask that... I am offending against my own ordering. Pray proceed, Mr. Hook. What else have you?
There are other things of interest, but I know that several members have questions to put before us, and others have brought exhibits. Will your lordship take them first?
With whom shall we begin? Ah, Sir Robert Murray, I see clearly that you wish to speak. We must always give you first place, since it was you who brought from the king the happy news that he would be our patron and guardian.
But indeed it was I that was the most happy on that day 2 years ago. Mr. President, I would ask a question. The Earl of Sandwich hath assured me that at the depth of 60 fathom water, 6 men could pull up an anchor, which, when it came near the surface, 10 men could scarce do. You will remember what we were told of an experiment by Dr. Power. A brass lamp that was an exact pound weight at the top of a mine pit, weighed at the bottom thereof, being 68 yards distant from the top, lighter by an ounce at least. These things seem to me very remarkable, Mr. President. May I ask that it be tried whether bodies vary in their weight when they are sunk to different depths underwater?
Who will answer that? I see our good friend Mr. Christopher Wren is ready to speak.
I say there will be no difference that will make an observable if the wearer, miners and builders who raise and lower weights through great distances would have found it out long ago. Of the sea, I know not, but I do doubt there also.
My lord.
Mr. Boyle, you wish to speak?
Sir, I perceive a connection between this matter and that which you, my lord, and I put among the questions which we sent to be tried at the Pico of Tenerife. To try by an hourglass, you remember, whether a pendulum clock doth go faster or slower at the top of the hill than below.
These are interesting questions, and I do suppose of great importance. Shall we order that Sir Robert's experiment be tried?
Yes.
Very, very well. That is to be tried.
I have an account also to present to the Society showing how fires are used in Belgium for the ventilation of mines. You'd know, Mr. President, that our miners must go ever deeper to win the coal, and that they meet noxious and indeed deadly vapors. This matter grows more important every day.
I see one of our visitors who is anxious to speak. Yes, sir.
Mr. President, I have a letter from a Dr. Jessop in Yorkshire who does say that when any man is badly overcome, they do fill him with good ale and lay him on his belly on the ground, and do place his head over a hole. And that if that fail, they do conclude him desperate.
I thank you, sir. That is very interesting. We must proceed. Mr. Hook.
Sir, there is one here who has a curious experiment and begs leave to show it.
Good. Sir, will you please come forward? Have you all that you want for your experiment?
Mr. President, it hath been said that a spider cannot cross the powder of a unicorn's horn. I propose to try the experiment before you.
Oh, but why try it? We've all been told that it's true. We know it's true. Now, sir, is there not something dangerous, even impious, in doubting what has been handed down from generation to generation? I am, sir, but a visitor to your meeting, and I crave your pardon humbly for speaking. It is my alarm that urges me. This, sir, is but one example of a practice that I fear. Do you do well to doubt ancient rules?
Nay, sir, I do think you are in error. We do not ascribe a falseness to our fathers and tutors. They were surely honest, but did they know? Which of them tried this experiment? Nay, sir, let us try now. Proceed with the experiment.
Sir, I have made a ring of the powder of the unicorn's horn upon the table. Gentlemen, will you gather round?
Whence the horn?
You will remember that on that day when we asked my Lord of Buckingham to order his chemist to try the vapour of carbon, he did present a unicorn's horn to the society.
Yes. Now I do remember. Proceed.
I have here a spider. I place him in the middle of the ring. Now let's watch.
He doesn't move. Push him.
Oh, sir, do you urge him?
Why?
Yes, you, sir.
Well,
now he's moving. Soon he'll come to the powder. Look, he's crossed it.
Why, he's standing on it.
He's standing on it.
Sir, this is strange.
So we have been told that which is not true.
Sir, this experiment cannot be a true one. I do doubt whether the horn was that of a real unicorn. We cannot have been told falsely.
To my thinking, the experiment is true. The spider is really a spider, and I do not doubt my Lord Buckingham's word, nor that of Mr. Hook.
It is not right to be...
Mr. President, His Majesty the King approaches.
Well, gentlemen, I do perceive that you are busy. What is it that you do?
Your Majesty, let me first thank Your Majesty for your continuous interest, which doth strengthen us in all our doings. We have already heard today some curious matters, but we think to tell you, if it pleases you, of a strange experiment which our assistant, Mr. Hook, hath just performed. He has weighed the air very clearly and well.
Weighed the... Oh, gentlemen, gentlemen, is it for this that I've granted you a charter and made you a royal society? It doth seem to me that you have done nothing but weigh the air since you set. Well, well, tell me how you do it, and then tell me why.
We must indeed implore your Majesty's patience. We will try to show you both the manner and the purpose of this trial. Let Mr. Hook speak.
Your Majesty, I have taken a great vessel which contains 119 English pints, and I pretty well exhausted it of air by the rarefying engine. I then counterpoised it in an exact pair of scales. When the air was again admitted into the vessel was found to be grown heavier. The weights that were added to the counterpoise to bring it again to an equilibrium amounting to 2 ounces, 1 dram, 15 grains avoirdupois, almost. From whence I do calculate that water is 1,000 times heavier, almost, than air.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do take it that you must be right. But now, why do you think so much of this trial?
Mr. Boyle, that you shall satisfy His Majesty on this point, since you have made trials of so many kinds with the air.
Your Majesty, the President doth speak of my engine, wherewith I measure the spring of the air. Your Majesty, the air doth surround us, and the lives of all things living depend upon it. Nor can a fire burn without it, as we have proved by placing a lamp and birds and animals in a receiver. And when we've drawn away the air, as we now know how to do by the rarefying engine, the lamp has gone out and the animals have died. Your Majesty, without the air, no bird could fly, no ship could sail. When the high winds do harm the forests and the works of men, it is because of the weight of air that is hurled against them. It is easy to show, Your Majesty, that if Mr. Hook has made a true measure, the air in this room doth weigh almost a ton. Yes, a ton. That is so, gentlemen, a ton. And we do understand its power when it forms the driving wind. The weight of air and the spring of air, these are great matters, Your Majesty, and surely we do well to make these trials. Is it not well, Your Majesty, that we try to understand that upon which our lives depend, and so many of our works? We do use the properties of the air when we make pumps to draw the water out of our mines. The diving bell, with which we make experiment at Deptford, as Your Majesty knows, does work by the spring of the air. And
And if we can make a man able to work underwater by its means, great gain will come to shipping and to works underwater, as Your Majesty will see. I might say far more, but I will not weary Your Majesty.
Yes, yes, I do see your point.
Your Majesty will have in mind the work to be done on the mole at Tangier.
Yes, and it is said that in Holland is a man who, by such a device, stays long underwater and has drawn many thousands of guilders from a ship that was sunk.
Your Majesty, this is great business. For surely Your Majesty's Navy is in urgent need of such devices.
Oh, who is this who speaks so warmly for the Navy?
His name is Pepys, Your Majesty. Mr. Samuel Pepys. He doth attend our meetings at times. He is in Your Majesty's service, and he is ever aroused if any matter arises which touches the business of the Navy. He's a very good man, they say.
Then he's a man after my own heart. For I do say that who loves the Navy loves this realm of England. And now, gentlemen, I leave you. I do commend your labors.
Now, gentlemen, we will continue. Mr. Hook, what is still in store for us?
I believe, my lord, that Mr. Hoskins wishes to speak of the production of bees out of dead bullocks. Mr. Evelyn has sent a very interesting account of the width of the rings in trees. Sir Robert Murray would tell us of how, on the coast of Coromandel, they do cool drinks by exposing them in bottles to the scorching heat of the sun all day long. And, my lord, it is urgent that we consider the question of the tides, a question now grown to such a height since the ships that sail to America are so much greater than the older ships.
Stop, Mr. Hook. The list grows too long. I think, gentlemen, that we had best consider...
And so the meeting fades away. I wonder how often you wanted to interrupt and tell them they were really wasting their time. Now, I may add that all the matters discussed at this imaginary meeting really were discussed at the early meetings of the Royal Society. You may like a little explanation of some of the terms used and of the matters they talked about. The spring of the air is its elasticity. The rarefying engine is what we call an air pump. Boyle's law relates to the spring of the air. Hooke's law relates to the spring of solid bodies. When a force is applied to bend or stretch a body, the effect is proportional to the force applied. The quaint word observable is a thing to be observed. Christopher Wren was quite right in saying there was no difference in the weights of the lamp and the anchor in the cases described of an amount that they could perceive. Boyle rightly supposed that the pendulum might behave differently at the top and the bottom of a mountain, but a very small difference would escape the experimenters of that day. Sir Robert Murray had a garbled account of the cooling of water in hot countries. The bottle must be porous and must be hung in the shade, and the hotter the wind that blows on it, the better, because evaporation produces cooling. The experiment on air and what they said about air were highly important. Pumping minds dry had become a first necessity. Later on, the steam engine was founded on a knowledge of the laws of gases. So also tide tables were becoming a necessity in navigation. You will see what great things came of this method experiment.